Can't you see it? A glistening 100-megawatt solar field begging to be built? It's photovoltaic modules and balance of system powering a renewable energy tomorrow that's squeaky clean? We know that unless you have the right supplier, that world might just be a fantasy. But here at Graybar, with years of renewables experience, we live in that world. Get in touch to see for yourself.
We are now ready to depart.
Book your visit at graybar.com. Yep, Graybar does that.
Imagine uncovering the secrets that others missed. A hidden clue, a silent witness, a twist that changes everything. I'm Carter Roy, host of Murder True Crime Stories, a Crime House original podcast. Join me every Tuesday as we dive into a famous solved or unsolved murder case. Follow and listen to Murder True Crime Stories, an Odyssey podcast in partnership with Crime House Studios. Available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
This from Ted to open up the show, Denton. Ted writes, "Delusional Kevin is back after 10 years. I'll give you credit for your preseason call on the team's record, but we're not a good team. We have a great player. Tampa is much better, and the season ends Sunday night in a blowout loss." Thank you, Ted. Appreciate that. Appreciate the compliment on getting... I actually was off on the season prediction by 2 games. I had them at 10-7 and in a wild card playoff game. They won 12. And let's be fair here. Nobody has blown them out, okay? Since the opener, and I know it was against Tampa, but their losses were all winnable games. Every single one of them, including the Philadelphia game on Thursday night, which was their biggest loss other than the opener. They lost to Dallas by 8, but, you know, there was the... you know, return at the end on the onside kick for the second kickoff return for a touchdown. No. They're not going to get blown out. It can happen. It's the NFL. But this team has not been blown out since the opener, and the opener doesn't really matter. The opener is a completely different situation. It is always in the NFL a major head fake week one, if not the first 2 or 3 weeks of the season. And Washington's a completely different team. Tampa Bay is a completely different team. Tampa is better on offense and they're worse on defense. Washington's much better on offense and probably the same on defense, actually. But delusional Kevin, there was a time, and it wasn't delusional, it was based on what they were, you know, in 2015, 2016. I'm assuming that that's what you're referring to. I was more optimistic than pessimistic, and then for about 8 years, I was pretty much pessimistic. But it's based on what we're observing in the moment, right? I mean, I'm observing a team that... isn't just one player. You're right. It's not a great roster around a great player. Not yet, anyway. And we will have time to fix that. They'll have time to fix that in the coming off seasons ahead. But you can't win 12 games in the NFL if you're not a good team. I think 10, 9, you know, wins... you can be a team that isn't good and somehow schedule your way, or when I say schedule, you get the luck of the schedule, get the luck of the bounce, you know, into a 9-win season or a 10-win season. 12 wins is pretty difficult if you're not a good team. I would agree that the roster is not a great roster. It might not even be a good roster overall, but they do have, for the first time in a long time, a really good player at the most important position on the field, and that masks a lot of other things and can make you and can be a contributor to you being a good team, by the way, as can your head coach and the staff, because that's part of the team. I have a hard time saying anything other than it's not a great roster. I think it's really hard to call a 12-win team not a good team, just a great player. And it's in terms of Tampa being much better in the season ending Sunday night in a blowout, again, they haven't been blown out since the opener. Every game has been winnable for them. Tampa has a better roster. Tampa has, in aggregate, better players in terms of the number of good players, but they are banged up on defense, especially on the back end. They have not been very good defensively against teams that can throw the football and good offensive teams, but they are good offensively. There's no doubt about that, but they aren't much better. And the odds makers have told you that they're not much better. They're a three-point favorite, and you get three for being the home team. So on a neutral field, the odds makers see this as a dead even matchup. I do believe that they have a chance to win the game. For those of you who agree with me that the game Sunday night is more than winnable, I mean, how confident are you? I'm not like, I'm not to the point where I'm like predicting a win, like an easy win, but I am absolutely not going to be surprised at all if they win the game Sunday night. Of course it's a winnable game. Thank you, Ted, for that optimism to start the show. I don't mind pessimism. I don't mind constructive, you know, pessimism, but you're just a little bit hyperbolic. I wasn't delusional with 2015 and 2016. I said the entire time, they're really good on offense. They suck on defense. That was 2015 and 2016. By the way, they were even worse on defense in 2015 and 2016 than they've been this year. But they weren't as dynamic on offense. I mean, they had better players on offense overall. I mean, DeSean Jackson, Pierre Garçon, Jordan Reed, Chris Thompson, Kirk Cousins, Trent Williams, they had a squad on offense. But I'd take this quarterback situation, of course, 10 times out of 10 over the one we had in 2015-2016, even though the one we had in 2015-2016 was a more than capable quarterback situation that they should have stuck with, but they were too stupid to do it and do it early. But I don't think I was delusional back then, Ted. I think I was just optimistic that they could, you know, compete offensively, which is what they did. Look, the playoff game against Green Bay after the 2015 season, if DeSean Jackson doesn't inexplicably go out of bounds at the half-yard line instead of, you know, pushing the ball forward and breaking the plane, they would have been up 12-0. In that game, they were up 5-0. They ended up kicking the field goal to go up 8-0 after they didn't get it in with a penalty, I think. DeSean, if he had just put the ball over the plane, they would have been up 12-0 against that Packer team. I'm not saying that they would have won the game, but they were more than competitive offensively in that game. They just couldn't get off the field against the Packers eventually as that game went on. I sometimes forget that there was a playoff game in between that one and the one they'll play Sunday night, Denton. The 2020 game against Tampa Bay as a 7-9 division winner, it is the last time this franchise was in the playoffs. And it was a playoff game. And by the way, it was a competitive playoff game. Not as competitive as some of you wanted to make it out to be. We've gone through that before. Some of you got a little bit carried away with the Taylor Heinicke thing. And, oh my God, Taylor Heinicke is the only guy that really had a shot, you know, to beat Tom Brady. No, actually, they should have or could have lost to Green Bay, New Orleans after. It was New Orleans first, right? It was New Orleans first, then Green Bay? No, Tampa beat New Orleans and then Green Bay, right? On the road?
Yeah.
Yeah. And those games actually were closer than the game against Tampa Bay here at FedEx that night. Look, what was true about that night is that offensively, Taylor Heinicke and company, Terry McLaurin, they kept Washington in a game in which they could not stop Tampa Bay. Defensively. In fact, there were 5 dropped passes in that game. Chris Godwin had 4 dropped passes in that playoff game. Tampa still scored 31 points, rolled up over 500 yards of offense, and it may have been close to 600 yards without the drops. That was the problem. It wasn't Taylor. Taylor gave him a chance, no doubt. You know, he gave them a chance. Terry gave him a chance. I forget who else played really well that night. Was McKissick a big part of that game? I'm trying to remember. Could pull up the box score.
Heinicke was the team's leading passer and rusher. Cam Sims, 7 catches, 104 yards.
Cam Sims.
Cam Sims.
7 catches, 104 yards. Yeah. Well, what did Terry have that night?
Hold Terry on, I got it now. 6 for 75.
There it is, 6 for 75. Logan Thomas, 5 catches, 74 yards. Steven Sims, 3 for 33. J.D. McKissick, 2 catches, 8 yards. 2 carries, 5 yards. I liked McKissick, man. McKissick actually reminds me, I mean, he's like a poor man's Austin Ekeler, but he had the serious injury, too, that basically ended his career. But look at Tampa Bay in that box score, Denton. First of all, 507 yards of offense. I knew it was more than 500. Brady was 22 of 40 for 381, 2 touchdowns, no picks. Godwin, I remember, had 4 drops in that game. And if you look at his numbers, it was 5 of 79. He was targeted 12 times. 4 of the 12 targets were drops for big yardage plays, chunk yardage plays. Evans, 6 for 119 in that game. I guess the point being, of course I remember that. It was during COVID. It was weird the entire season, including, you know, the no fans and the whole thing. And I didn't think that they had a chance to win that game. What were they? What was the point spread in that game? What didn't it go off at double digits or not? Was Tampa a double-digit favorite on the road?
Tampa was a... It doesn't say on here. I think it was
Pro
large.
Football Reference has it. Pro Football Reference will always have the point spread. I think it may have been like double digits and may have come down. Hold on. Yeah. I'll find it here in a moment. We were the Washington football team that year. That's for sure.
It looks like it wasn't double digits. It was 8.5.
Yeah. No, I see 10. On Pro Football Reference, I see Tampa Bay went off as a 10-point favorite.
Oh, I'll trust them over the other site then.
Yeah. Pro Football Reference always includes, you know, weather conditions at kickoff, the length of the game, and the Vegas point spread along with the over-under. Tampa Bay was minus 10, and the total was 45 in that game. So there you go. Yeah, I guess the last time I feel like they played in a real playoff game was that game against Green Bay. And the last time I actually thought they had a legitimate chance to make a run was 2012. And we know how that ended. Ugh, that didn't end well at all. I can't wait for Sunday night. I think they got a legit shot to win the game. We've talked about it. We'll talk about it more today, tomorrow, and Friday. Yeah, I mean, to Ted's point, they have a great player at the most important position on the field, and that often is the difference in these big one-and-done games. So his first chance, you know, in a one-and-done, you know, in a win-or-go-home game, this will be our first chance to see him, first chance to see this, you know, coaching staff together, how they handle it, first chance to see how some of the others, Terry played in a playoff game in 2020, so he's got some experience with it. And there are certainly players on the team that have had experience in playoff games, all the Dallas guys, you know, Austin Ekeler, clearly. So we'll see what happens. But I give them a legitimate shot to win the game Sunday night. We will save our predictions for Friday's show, but don't be surprised if I predict a narrow victory. And on to Detroit we go. By the way, it could be on to either LA or Minnesota we go, depending on the result of the Green Bay-Philadelphia game. Today's a big day because teams will, you know, put out their first injury report. We're going to find out in Philadelphia what the status of Jalen Hurts is for sure. That's an intriguing story. And for our game, obviously, we're going to find out what Dan Quinn said on Monday is true. And that is he actually is upbeat about the health of the team going into the playoff game. We will certainly get those. By the way, important to see what Tampa's got coming back. I think there is a possibility Antoine Winfield Jr. is back, right, Denton? Is that that's a possibility?
It is a possibility. I had read something earlier this week that there is worry that that will not be the case, though. So it feels
Jordan
like that's
Whitehead's 50-50. Done, right?
I believe so.
They missed him for some games. I mean, their secondary has been a mess. There's going to be an opportunity to, you know, watch our guy go to work. A lot of quick stuff, a lot of hitches, a lot of get it out quickly, and then they inch up a little bit and we take some deep shots. Big holes on, you know, in zone coverage. Bowles plays a lot of both. Plays a lot of man, plays a lot of zone, depending on the opponent. Todd Bowles is a total whatever it takes in that particular game based on the opponent they're facing. He is a true defensive mastermind and has been for a long time. You can say whatever you want about Todd Bowles as a head coach. Todd Bowles has been one of the most respected defensive coordinators, defensive minds, defensive play callers, defensive game planners in the game going back years now. So they will have a plan. But do they have the players on the back end to match? You know, will we get more zone coverage against Jaden Daniels? They've given up a lot of scrambling yards, and they haven't played a true dual-threat quarterback since they faced Lamar Jackson in that Monday night game way back in October. You know, they played Mahomes. You know, they remember they lost that overtime game, had a chance to go for two, didn't do it. They played Mahomes in that game. Other than that, you go through the quarterbacks they have faced. You know, Bryce Young can move around. Did Daniel Jones play in the game that they played them in, or was that Daniel Jones' first game out? Yeah, it was his first game out. They started Tommy DeVito in the game in which they beat the Giants. But Bryce Young had some success against them. Kirk Cousins had incredible success against Tampa twice. I mean, basically threw for 800 yards in two games against Tampa. But you got a shot to move. You can't play too much man coverage against Jaden. And Jaden's been very good against zone coverage. So we'll see what happens. They do stop the run, though. There is no doubt that Tampa can stop the run. So I don't know if you bang your head trying to run Brian Robinson Jr. or even Austin Ekeler until you've loosened them up through the air. How many playoff wins do you see for our team? 301-230-0980, 301-230-0980. I did put out a poll on Twitter at Kevin Sheehan DC, and because there are only four possibilities to poll answers, I said how many NFC playoff wins, because zero's a possibility, one's a possibility, two's a possibility, three's a possibility, and so is four, right? I mean, if they won the Super Bowl, that would be four playoff wins, three in the NFC playoffs and one in the Super Bowl. So I'm asking you on the phone something different than I'm asking via Twitter, because there's only so much capability. I guess I could have gone 3+ as the last answer. Probably should have done that. How many playoff wins do you see Washington getting starting Sunday night in Tampa? 301-230-0980. Denton, I'll let you answer the question first.
Well, at least one for sure. I would say just one. I think they beat Tampa Bay, and then they match up more likely than not with Detroit. Detroit has too much offense for their defense to hang with. They lose in a shootout, but they get at least one. I'm very serious when I say that I think Jaden leads them on a victory in Tampa Bay. He always plays the second time against teams really, really well in full games. He didn't play a full game against Dallas, but he did in Philadelphia. He did against the Giants, and we remember talking about that Giants game. I think seeing Tampa Bay a second time, even though they're a vastly different team, I think he gets at least one win. So I'm gonna say one, and I'm going to cap it at one, but I do think they get a win.
Do you know, with Green Bay and Philadelphia playing right before we play on Sunday night, if Green Bay pulled off the win in Philly, then Washington won, they would go to LA or to Minnesota in the divisional round. I wish I knew the Green Bay-Philadelphia result at this point, because I think they'd have a chance in either one of those two places. I would not give them a high-level chance of winning in Detroit. Although, I give them a chance against anybody. I'm going to say 1-2. I think they're going to win Sunday night. I mean, I don't feel strongly about this on Sunday night, but I definitely can see a win. I can see a 31-point-plus, you know, offensive game and winning, you know, 34-28 in overtime, or 31-28 in overtime, or 30-27 or something like that. I can definitely see that as a potential result. So I'll go one. I'll go one. If I felt really good about Green Bay beating Philly, and we tomorrow, if Jalen Hurts doesn't practice today and he's iffy, do we have any Jalen Hurts information yet?
I am looking that up as you speak. The Eagles just waived Ian Book, which I think is a good sign.
Yeah. Sirianni says Jalen Hurts is practicing today, according to Mike Garofalo. Okay, so, I mean, I think Philly's better than Green Bay, although that should be a hell of a game. A hell of a game. But if you told me you beat Tampa and you play the Rams or the Vikings, you know, you got a shot against either one. A better shot than you do against Detroit. But I'll go one. 301. I was about to give my own phone number. 301-230-0980. 301-230-0980. By the way, somebody said that I did that several years ago. They said, that's not the call-in number. What number did you give? And I went back and listened to it afterwards. And I had given my cell phone number. 301-230-0980. 301-230-0980. How many playoff wins for Washington this year? We'll take calls when we come back. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980 and the Team980.com.
Wizards in action last night. They fell to the Houston Rockets 135-112. Corey Kispert led the team with 23 off the bench. Georgetown fell to Marquette 74-66. It was only the Hoyas' third loss of the season. They are an impressive 12-3. They get UConn this weekend on Saturday. Elsewhere in college hoops, Tennessee got shredded by Florida. The number one team of the nation goes down by nearly 30 points. In fact, 30 to be exact, 73-43, one of the biggest losses in Tennessee program history. In the NFL, the Raiders fired Antonio Pierce, which means they are now in the coaching search. And in the NFL, elsewhere in the NFL, the Cowboys blocked Mike McCarthy from interviewing for the Bears job. His contract expired today. But the Cowboys have an exclusive negotiating rights window until December 14th. And that's what's trending.
How many playoff wins for our team? 301-230-0980, 301-230-0980. I have gone one. Denton's gone one. Just put up a poll on X at Kevin Sheehan DC. So far, the votes are indicating that people are in agreement with us. 52.7% of the votes have one win. Now, that poll, I should have included 3+ as the last option, is for NFC playoff wins. But we're talking about the entirety of the postseason. How many wins for Washington in the postseason? Why? As well, give us an explanation. Let's start with our guy, Aveen. Aveen, go ahead.
Hey, Kevin. I think they're capable of two as long as they avoid Detroit. I think Detroit's the only team we would feel overwhelmed by. But you know what teams do well in the playoffs, what teams sometimes overperform earlier than expected. Teams with elite MVP-style quarterbacks that lead elite offenses. In the NFC, we have the best playmaking quarterback, the best extend-the-play quarterback, the quarterback most capable of willing his team to wins. And I just think in the playoffs, he's going to be in do or die mode. We're going to be so hard to get off the field on third and fourth downs because of that. And I can see quarterbacks like Sam Darnold and a more diminished version of Stafford, Baker Mayfield having hiccups that Jaden Daniels won't have. So as long as we avoid Detroit, I'm saying two games.
Yeah, it's a good point, too, that you made, Aveen. Last year, Jordan Love, as an example, right? You know, goes on the road, beats Dallas as a sizable dog. I forget what the point spread was. They almost pulls it off playing high-level quarterback football at Detroit, almost pulls it off. Burrow's first opportunity in the playoffs. He was a quarterback. First year, Denton to the Super Bowl, right, for Burrow?
Yeah, first year in the postseason. Runs
yeah, because they beat the Titans in that playoff game that we talked about, and then they upset the Chiefs in the AFC title game. So the teams that were, you know, lower seeded that made runs all did so with, you know, being led by outstanding quarterback play. You know, you can find the one upset in a postseason with a team not, you know, having an outstanding quarterback, but you really can't find a run for first. I'm talking about for a first time, you know, a young quarterback. You got to have that. Let's go to Ross. Ross, how many playoff wins for Washington this year?
Hey, what's going on, Kevin? I'm glad your son's doing well and he's safe, man, first and foremost.
Yeah, thanks. He's not there. He's no actually problem, traveling, man, for work, so he's not in L.A. He just sent us a picture, thank though. I shared it with Denton. It's amazing, the view from their house. It's just, it looks like a scene from a movie. Unbelievable. All right, go ahead. Thanks, though.
No problem, man. So, it'll be different, man. I think Washington's more than capable of winning two, but we need chaos to ensue. We need, well, we don't need anything. We just go out there and play our game. I think we can win two, but I got Green Bay beating Philly, which means we can beat either L.A., which speaks for itself, and then, you know, Minnesota. I think, you know, Sam Darnold won't see it. I think the playoffs, the lights might be too bright for him in that spot. I don't know if he's ever played in a high-profile playoff game before. And then Detroit, they're just way too banged up to handle Jaden Daniels on offense. And before I hop off here, how refreshing is it that we did not beat Dallas last year in Week 18? I remember so many callers called in scolding you and lecturing you about how it's beat Dallas no matter what. If we beat Dallas last year, we're not in this position. We're probably talking about how encouraged we are with J.J. McCarthy after a 6-11 season or something like that. That's why it's always important that the fans should just be fans and let the people in the office do their thing. But I got them winning.
Yeah, but they didn't try to lose those games. Jacoby Brissett nearly beat the Jets, the Rams, and, you know, and was going to start that game against the Cowboys, or maybe he wasn't. I think they brought Hal back for that game and the game before. What was the game before?
To bring them back, from what I heard.
Yeah, the Zuerlein kick was crucial. 54, 53 yards or whatever it was to beat him on Christmas Eve. That was, yeah, I mean, you didn't last year with the quarterbacks, and it was a totally unusual year with all of the options. You wanted the highest pick possible. New England, by beating Buffalo, and I know that they drafted Drake May, but New England, by beating Buffalo, dropped four spots from number one to number four in the draft. Joe Milton went out and beat the Bills. You can't ask the guys that haven't played not to play their best. They're playing for jobs. But, yeah, no, we can thank Greg Zuerlein, and we can thank Jacoby Brissett, who decided, didn't he get hurt before those final two games? And fortunately, we got Sam Howell back in there, which pretty much meant there wasn't much of a chance of winning against San Francisco or Dallas over the final two. Let's go to Dennis in Virginia. Dennis, go ahead. How many playoff wins for Washington this year?
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you, Dennis.
To use one of your words, it's a scenario. The team to watch in these playoffs is Green Bay. If Green Bay can go on the run and beat Philly, then they will play Detroit.
Yeah,
and that's in a division, so I can go either way. And
right.
we win our game
against Detroit, and they were close in the first two.
Yep, and Washington will play either one of Minnesota or L.A. Then you got a chance to host the NFC Championship game. That's the road to the Super Bowl.
All right, so that's right now, let's just play that out. If Washington as a 6 seed hosted Green Bay as the 7 in the NFC title game, who would you like?
It's icing on the cake because
No. If you get there, you gotta win that game.
Yeah, you got to win the game. That's why I say that's the road to the Super Bowl. I think they can win three games. That's the least of the pathway of least resistance.
Yeah,
because if it goes traditional, the top teams win their games. I just don't think we have enough to beat them at their place.
Yeah, I think what really worries me the most, and I think I've said this going back to early in the season, when it became clear that there was a chance this team could end up winning a lot more games and being a potential playoff team, is that even with a great quarterback and a great offense, when you can't stop people and when you specifically can't stop the run, it's really hard to win potentially three road games to get to a Super Bowl. You got to be at least average on defense. And the thing is they're going to play a team that can run the football against them on Sunday night, even if it were either the Rams or Vikings, two teams that can run the football. And then the Lions obviously can run the football. So that's like bringing it back to I've gotten swayed by Jaden and by the offense and the capability of it, and I know that they're capable of outscoring people, but can you really outscore three teams on the road that can all run the ball against your defense that cannot stop the run and win three in a row? Probably not. Frank in Charlotte. Frank, go ahead. How many wins in the postseason for our team?
Hey, good afternoon. All right, good afternoon, Kevin. I'll make it quick. I think it's going to be zero, and I'll give you why. The reason why. One, we'll start off every time that you say, and I like you, Kevin. I go back to watching you and you was on the Riggo show when you actually had hair. It was you and Riggo, yeah. And I think it was another guy. So
Jerry,
it was a great show. I remember it was a long time ago. You were actually on a live video feed. But every time that you say that we're going to win, for some reason, we lose. Whenever you're bullish about us winning, we lose.
Really?
And so
I think I've done pretty well this year with the predictions. Okay. You might be thinking about somebody else, but I think the predictions on these games have gone pretty well this year. But go ahead. Okay. I'm not going to get defensive about it. I don't have my record.
Okay. And I hope you don't get defensive. I'm sorry. I apologize if you are. But anyway, I think they're going to lose because we have a three technique problem. Those two D tackles and even the rookie that we got. They do not hold their gaps.
That's true.
And teams are going to gash us on the backside. And they're undisciplined rushers when they go upfield. And John Allen, I think he disrupted the actual rotation that we did have when he came back. Because now he's freelance and he's going back to his same old habits. And so he's getting washed down the field. There's actually a film. If you actually watch the all 22 and you just isolate on John Allen, you will see how many times he gets washed or how many times he's out of his gap.
I think the most interesting thing about watching the All-22 from Sunday was to see how many times Duron lined up as the left defensive end. And that change here in the last couple of weeks because they cannot set the edge. And they've turned to 94 Duron to try to set the edge. Now, it doesn't mean he's not playing inside, and you've seen it too. I think Duron's actually handled the double team much worse than John has this year. I think Duron's struggled against the double team this year.
Well, they all three play behind blocks. When you play behind blocks, man, you're going to get gashed. They have to be in front of blocks. And so that messes up the second level, which is Bobby Wagner and them trying to get their run fits. And so that's the issue we have. We can solve that. We might win one or two. Okay.
Yeah. Thank you, Frank. Have a good appreciate day. It. By the way, my buddy just said Sheehan had 24-19 as the final score on Sunday. What was it, Denton? What was the final score?
23-19.
I'm sorry. I messed that one up. My fault. I'll get it right next time. G from the shop. What's up? Happy New Year.
Yeah, Mike. Happy New Year, my brother. But y'all are tripping, man. 3+, man. Like you said, we put 3+. We went in the Super Bowl, man, for the simple fact. On paper, and my eye test has showed me Detroit, Baltimore, and Philly, in my opinion, and Buffalo, in my opinion, they the best teams on my eye test. But nobody is definitively the best team in the league. Kansas City has been up and down playing with their food all year. Yeah, they got Michael Jordan, but nobody is that much better than us. Yeah, we can't stop the run, but we in the tournament. I done seen Eli Manning get in the tournament 2 times when they was talking about firing Coughlin. 9-7, and right. He beat the so-called GOAT in Brady twice. So if we in it this year, especially when there ain't no definitive favorite powerhouse, nah, we winning the Super Bowl this year, and we going to be down on Pennsylvania Avenue smoking good, like I told you earlier.
I'm going to seek you out for the good stuff. But I agree. You know, I agree with you that this is wide open in the NFC in particular. I think the AFC with the Steelers, with the way they're playing, with Houston, I don't think those teams are capable of winning three games and getting to the Super Bowl. I do think everybody in the NFC, if it breaks right, has a chance to go on a run here. Doesn't mean that I don't think Detroit's, you know, and Philly are better than everybody else, but not like the 49ers last year. I really felt like it'd be a shocker if they didn't end up in the Super Bowl. All right, man.
Yeah, and see, that's what everybody think about Detroit. And until Detroit wins the Super Bowl, I will not believe in the Lions, man.
But it's more than that. It's just that Detroit's so injured on defense in particular. All right, I got to run. Thanks. All right, Greg Allman is with us. Greg covers the NFL and the Bucks for Fox Sports. You can follow Greg on X, on Twitter, at Greg, AUMAN. Greg, thanks for doing this. I want to just start by asking you, because we've talked about a lot about it from our team's standpoint. Going into this game, the Buccaneers are most confident in what and then most concerned in what? Or with what?
Right. That's a good question. I would say they probably are most confident in the offense and specifically the run game and their offensive line. Just the way that's come together, it's probably where they're the most improved this year. Dead last in the NFL in yards per game and yards per carry last year, and now they're top five, which is a crazy turnaround. And it's a couple different things that have done that. But that's probably what they do best, and especially seeing Washington with kind of a bottom five run defense statistically, that's probably where they're going to try to attack them on Sunday, I think. Conversely, it's definitely the defense and the secondary that's a concern. They've just been really hit hard by injuries. They were down three starters on Sunday. We'll be shorthanded again against Washington, and I think it's one of those where they're like 29th in pass defense. I think they did well to get Jaden Daniels in week one as he's just getting a feel for who he is and what it's like in the NFL. So to beat them and beat them as easily as they did in week one, I really thought some of that was a function of just getting him before he knows what he's doing. And they won't have that on Sunday, so it's definitely a real challenge. This could be a high-scoring game that way.
Yeah, I mean, that certainly seems to be what the odds makers think, too. It's the highest total of any of these six wild card games. Let me just go back to the run game. You talked about the offensive line. Give me the difference Bucky Irving's made versus Rashad White, who I thought was a good back, you know, coming into this year. And before the opener, I talked about Rashad White before that opener. And Bucky Irving, by the way, kind of had his first success in the second half of the opener against Washington. But just how much has he meant, the emergence of this rookie from Oregon?
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of a big play potential, it's what they've sorely missed in the run game. I mean, they've been dead last in the NFL the last 2 years, really haven't had a steady runner since like Doug Martin in 15 or 16. So real long time since they've had somebody that can break out the big plays. And Bucky's been that. And over the course of the season, like you said, they like Rashad White. He's been their guy. But I think there's a big play aspect to Bucky, to where you saw the shift in from it being a job share and a 50-50 split to where literally Sunday against New Orleans, Rashad didn't have a touch, played like 18 snaps, did well in like pass protection on third downs and stuff. But you were used to maybe both getting 10 carries or something like that. And they've leaned really hard on Bucky the last couple of weeks and trusted him to be able to kind of drive home wins and even help them come back sometimes in the second half.
All right, what about the other rookie, Jalen McMillan? Chris Godwin goes out in that Monday night game against Baltimore. They lose him for the year. McMillan scored a touchdown in the opener, but I think it sounds like you're doing the same thing we're doing, which is kind of discounting week one. Both teams are much different. Right. But just talk about McMillan's emergence as the number two to Evans.
Yeah, it's been wild what he's done. Where the last 5-6 weeks has just, especially with touchdowns, has I think led the NFL in touchdowns in the last 6 weeks of the season. Had another one on Sunday. I mean, if you think about the Sunday Saints game, they're down. They go for it on 4th and 8. and McMillan makes a catch for a first down. They get a penalty to get backed up, and then and two plays later, he gets a 32-yard touchdown on just a beautiful toe-tap sideline catch in the end zone. And he's done that. I mean, this is one of those where halfway through the year, you know how fans are. It's like, oh, this Jalen McMillan's a bust. Why would they put a third-round pick into a guy that's got, you know, 10 catches for the season? And the point I've made is that, you know, Chris Godwin was kind of the same way, that Godwin didn't do that much the first half of his rookie year, didn't get his first touchdown until the last game of the season. And it's like, you got to wait. It's kind of, everybody wants to call somebody a bust or say it's a bad draft pick 2 months into their NFL career. And that's really about where Jalen found himself and got Baker's confidence in him, probably cleaned up his route running a little bit. And again, the difference, I think he had 8 touchdowns to finish the year. I think maybe Brian Thomas is the only rookie with more touchdown catches than he had. And to do that, you know, essentially as a number 3 receiver for a decent chunk of the year, it's pretty wild.
Is there an X factor offensively? I had somebody on earlier in the week who talked about Sean Tucker's ability to be a big play, chunk play, game-breaking type of player. Do you view him that same way, or is there somebody else?
Yeah, it could be. I mean, Tucker's been a forgotten guy. It's one of those where, you know, Tucker was like NFC Offensive Player of the Week against the Saints and basically had like 190 yards in the second half against the Saints in 1 week and barely has had that since then in whatever, okay, 11 weeks or whatever it is. So I think he's somebody they've turned to. He's been their number 3 back. You know, early on was really just Bucky and Rashad for the most part. Tucker got in there, had more touches than Rashad did on Sunday. But no, he's made plays. He's a guy that could certainly try against a poor rush defense to use. Sometimes they'll bring him out in the first drive of the second half as fresh legs, as somebody that can really try to wear down a defense as you know, you got the same guys out there trying to stop the run, but if you can throw out somebody new with fresh legs, you might have some success. I don't think they're going to take Bucky off the field very much on Sunday. I think they really trust him and want him to be the guy out there, but if they needed a spell for a drive in the third quarter or something, Tucker could be the guy.
What about Cade Otton? A significant player until his injury a few weeks ago. Is he back on Sunday night or not? And if not, who's his replacement?
Yeah, I tend to think right now he is. They've been really careful. He's missed the last 3 games. The first time he's missed games in his NFL career. Really productive, like a 70-catch tight end. Stepped up. He was probably the initial guy that stepped up in the Godwin void to be somebody they could count on, especially on third down. So I think he tied for the team lead in third down catches. But no, he's been hurt. If he can't go, the next guy is a guy named Payne Durham, a second-year player. Had a touchdown on Sunday, had some big catches the week before. Not as prolific a catcher as Otten is, but guy that stepped in really well. They have a rookie named Devin Culp who had 2 big catches Sunday, has barely played this year, but has stepped up just in the last couple of weeks.
Talking to Greg Aumann, he covers the Bucs, covers the NFL for Fox Sports. 2 more offensively. Who gets the most credit for Baker Mayfield's kind of resurrected career in Tampa?
I mean, obviously Baker probably deserves most of the credit, but I mean, the 2 coordinators they've had, Baker's entire career is like a different coordinator every year, which isn't really great for continuity and development. But I think the last 2 here in Tampa have done a really good job of finding his strengths and playing to those. It was Dave Canales who, you know, got him last year and kind of had the initial resurrection, and now he's the Carolina head coach. And this year, a much bigger step forward with Liam Cohen, who was a Rams assistant and then came in here as the OC. Again, they've gone from, whatever, 20th last year as an offense to really top 5 in almost every aspect. You know, Baker tied for the NFL lead in interceptions. So, I mean, there were problems, I think. But I think most of those weren't like game killers or game-changing picks. So for him to have 41 touchdowns and 4,500 yards, broke the team record for completion percentage at over 70%. I think the stat that probably shows the offensive balance the best is they're literally the first team in NFL history to complete 70% of their passes and average 5 yards a carry. So that's, I think Mayfield's a big part of that. You know, his first year, he came to Tampa on like a 1-year, $4 million deal, just the biggest bargain for a quarterback you can imagine, and then was rewarded and got, whatever, 3 and 100 this year, $100 million. And you kind of worry, if he doesn't have that financial motivation, will he be the same quarterback? Will he be as good? And if anything, he's been better. So now, you know, he signed a 3-year deal. You have people wondering if he'll tear it up, because these days, $35 million for a starting quarterback is, I think he's 19th in the NFL. So a relative bargain that way. But again, it's neat the way the team has kind of built itself around him and embraced him. It's hard to follow Tom Brady and to take over a team from Tom Brady, but I think he has enough self-confidence and really swagger to pull that off.
By the way, what a stat. First team in NFL history to complete 70% or more, all the while averaging 5 yards per carry or more. And that's why Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Washington almost pulled it off, honestly. This year's Commanders team is almost there. They're at like 69.8% and 4.98 a carry. I mean, they were a couple passes basically away from doing the same.
Yeah, the big difference is it's the quarterback that's been at the yards per carry number, not the running backs, which is a big difference between the run game here and the run game in Tampa. You mentioned the 16 picks, led the league, you know, tied with Cousins for the most interceptions. And, you know, we've all watched enough of other teams, but you're there for every single throw. Why does he throw a lot of picks?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it really wasn't a problem except for maybe like a 5-game stretch. And I mean, they lost, whatever it was, 5 of 6 games in the middle of the year. And I think there was a point where he was pressing a little bit, trying to do too much. Baker is not a guy that necessarily gives up on many plays. That could be a good thing, but it can also lead to some bad throws. So of those, it's not like all 16 are on him. There's definitely, I mean, the one he had Sunday was a tipped ball at the line of scrimmage. He's a shorter guy, so you get some balls deflected at the line of scrimmage. But no, I think it's one of those where I think at times he tried to do too much. That's kind of the best thing and the worst thing about him as a quarterback. So, it's a big number. It's something that probably limited him early in his career. But I also think he's been pretty – I mean, the first half of this year, maybe weeks, you know, 1 through 7, was remarkably good at minimizing his turnovers. So I think he's had patches that have been bad. And again, I mean – this is not necessarily a turnover-driven defense that he has behind him. The Bucs only had 7 picks all year as a defense. It's the fewest in their franchise history. So I think it's all the more important in a playoff game to minimize those. It's got to be a 1-turnover game or a no-turnover game. You get much more than that. It's digging a hole that's going to be tough for them to get out of.
I mean, he also led the league per Pro Football Focus in turnover-worthy throws. You were able to watch him. Sometimes there can be a disconnect on that. It could be, you know, that there was pressure or it was a tip ball that should have been picked or whatever. Did he put a lot up for grabs, even the ones that didn't get picked?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely some that are, again, like this offense is counting on receiver and quarterback being on the same page in adjusting routes, in adjusting to coverages, and that can lead to some presumptions and some timed throws where if you're not on the same page, like Jalen McMillan. Again, one of the reasons he didn't go to him as much in the first half of the season is that they weren't necessarily on the same page, to where if a throw was slightly off, boom, there's a DB right there instead of the receiver. I think that's something they've kind of worked out the kinks with. I'm not saying the problem's gone away, but it's something that'll be, you know, a question mark and something to watch on Sunday for sure.
All right, other side of the ball, you talked about the injuries on the back end and the problems they've had there. Your guess as to who plays Sunday and who doesn't?
Yeah, the question marks on their defense, they actually had a safety, Jordan Whitehead, have a car accident on Saturday and fractured a bone in his neck. He won't play, and that's not an option. But I think everyone else is in play at least. Antoine Winfield, you know, was Pro Bowl safety a year ago. He practiced last week. I would think he's likely to play. I don't know if he'll be a full-strength type Antoine Winfield, but that's from a headiness, from a leadership standpoint, that's huge to have him back out there. Their second corner is a guy named Jamel Dean, who hurt his knee, did not practice. I would think he's possible, but unlikely. And that's a concern. That second corner is a guy named Josh Hayes, who would be a special teams player in any normal scenario. They lost another corner to injury, so their depth there is a vulnerability. So I would say safety, Winfield probably there, but corner, if Dean isn't there, that's a spot. Again, you know, right now with Washington, you think about one receiver and Zion McCollum probably go on McLaurin and try and neutralize him. So how well you can get your receiving depth to line up against the other corner and make plays is definitely a big part of the game.
You think have any sense as to what Todd Bowles will do defensively? Will he play more zone because you got a quarterback that can really take off and hurt, you know, a defense, especially if they've got their backs turned? How do you see Bowles sort of defending Washington?
Yeah, I mean, I would tell you normally with a rookie quarterback, with a young quarterback, they throw the kitchen sink at him, and it's a lot of different looks and a lot of different blitzes. The Bucs have, because of that injury in the middle of the field and missing some linebackers, they've had some weird, they call it a penny defense, that's like a 5-1-5 almost. Unusual things that you don't see. He will drop Vita Vea in coverage. He will drop outside linebackers in coverage in the middle of the field and do a lot of things that if you can see coming, you can take advantage of. But if you don't anticipate, can put guys where you'd think the ball should be safe to throw to. So there's the thing with Todd Bowles is a really, really intricate and complicated defense, and it's just a matter of whether his own players can solve it better than the opposing quarterbacks. And that's been a problem this year. There's been times where veteran quarterbacks, where I mean, Kirk Cousins had a terrible year but had 8 touchdowns against 1 interception against the Bucs, largely because he knew where to throw the ball and where to find the seams and the holes in the defense. So, you know, for Jaden Daniels, you know, he has probably more so than maybe anybody they faced except maybe Lamar this year, that threat of having to account for him, having to not have defenders, you know, run with their back to the quarterback. They have to know where he is so they can come and get him. So it's not, I think he rushed for 82 yards maybe in the first Bucs games. He had a good game, probably a better game running than he did passing in that first meeting. So like I said, they're going to try and take away the run first, at least the traditional run and the running
and they've
back
done that
the
well.
Run.
They've done that well.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Stopping Daniels, I would say, is another challenge. If they keep him to 50 yards, you've done well.
Right. All right. Two more for Greg Aumann, who covers the Bucs in the league for Fox Sports. Just the overall thought from all of you and the fan base about Todd Bowles. You know, I'm a big Todd Bowles fan. He played for our team here and won a Super Bowl here. So I've followed his career. I think he's been a great defensive mind in the NFL for a long time. But I know that at various points in time as a head coach, even in Tampa, there's been frustration with him. So where is everybody now on Bowles?
Yeah, I would say it's definitely a mixed bag. It's one of those where, I mean, Todd's won 3 division titles in his 3 years as a head coach. They had never won back-to-back division titles in their history before that. You know, I think some people will mitigate that by saying the NFC South is a crappy division and that one of those wins was with an 8-9 record. You know, last year was 9-8. But he has gone from, whatever, 8-9 to 10 wins from a point standpoint. Like, they had a negative point differential his first year as a division title, which is really hard to pull off. They're plus 117 now. So, I mean, they've taken care of things. And a lot of that, you'll have fans that don't want to give Bowles credit for Liam Cohen as an offensive coordinator because they've taken a big step forward on offense. But Bowles is the guy that hired Cohen, so you kind of have to give him credit for that. So, within games, this is a team that will have a bad quarter or a bad half early on. Again, Twitter is completely wanting Bowles fired during the game. And then that second half defense, I think they've given up 9 points in the second half of the last 5 games, which is amazing. Again, by the end, it's like, all right, well, maybe he should stick around for another game. But yeah, Bowles is, I mean, if you know Bowles, his demeanor is very level, even keel, does not show a lot of emotion. He followed Bruce Arians, who would drop F-bombs with the best of them and didn't mind throwing players under the bus. And Todd is, you know, a very loyal, protective coach. Even if it's obvious what went wrong in a play, he's not going to single a guy out. And I think sometimes fans want somebody that will scorched earth, throw guys under the bus, and then say that guy should have done this. That's not Todd, and it won't be. And Todd, to his credit, isn't changing, even though he knows there are fans that might like him to be different. I think Todd can tear somebody a new one in the locker room, in the privacy, cameras off, but he's not going to do it publicly. And that's who he's always been.
So that leads me to this, and it has nothing to do with Sunday night's game, but I have to ask you because I asked our other guest. I'm shocked that when at the end of the game Sunday, after New Orleans had failed on fourth down and it was a knee-out-the-game situation, that I view Todd Bowles as somewhat conservative, and he let Baker Mayfield throw a ball to Mike Evans so that Evans got over 1,000 yards with some level of risk. I mean, it was a knee-out-the-game situation, and you're division champs, and he put the ball up.
Right.
Were you guys surprised? Did that get a lot of conversation?
Sure. I mean, I think everybody here knows how much it means to Mike Evans. So there's fans here that would have done anything to get Mike that record. If it meant losing the division, they wanted Mike to get the record. But like you said, that's not Bowles. Bowles is Bowles went for it on 4th and 8 with 10 minutes left. And that's not really him. So it was neat to see. I think it's one of those where I think the people around him assured him they had a play in mind. If they motioned Mike, it'd be harder to get 2 or 3 guys on him in coverage. And that Baker actually kind of threw it wide. I mean, it was a nice catch for Mike as 8-yard catches go. But again, there's definitely a risk there. And then you know if you take a knee, you can't lose. If you throw a ball, it can go off Mike's hands and get returned for a pick six. They get a 2-point conversion. Now you're losing in overtime or something, and they would destroy him for that. But I think
yeah, would have destroyed him for that. I haven't seen the play yet. Was New Orleans expecting a knee down? Did it make the pass easier?
No, I think New Orleans was well aware he needed 5 yards for a thousand.
Okay.
So I think putting Mike in motion helped. There are two guys there, you know, at about the five-yard mark. And I don't think there was like a Brett Favre of indifference in terms of the Strahan record to letting Simeon right. record. I don't think they necessarily attacked him. The game's over. They knew the game's over. Whether you stop him at 3 yards or let him get 8 is pretty menial at that point.
I'm watching it right now. I mean, they're in shotgun. They're not in kneel down, you know, mode.
Yeah,
but that's pretty wild. I mean, it was a safe throw, too. But who knows? He drops it. The next one is a drop. They use their timeout. They get the ball back and would have been a disaster, although it wouldn't have mattered anyway because Atlanta lost. Greg, thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
Oh, no problem. Take care, you guys. Enjoy the game on Sunday.
Yep, Greg Aumann. Greg, AUMAN on X on Twitter, covers the Bucks and the NFL for Fox Sports. All right, 4-2 last weekend, 3-1 on the NFL games on Sunday. This from Steve. Public has crushed it in the NFL this year. How did you do it again? Thank you, Steve. That's a compliment. It's a good question, too. I'd have to do more research on it. My college record, which, you know, most people complain about typically early in the season, did really well, I know, on college games in kind of the second half of the season. But I think I just got the right NFL games more often than not. It is true, the public really over the last month of the NFL season really crushed a lot of sports books. And for whatever reason, I avoided those, you know, sides that more often than not, I probably would have had, but for reasons, typically because I knew that there was certain bettors and certain sharp bettors on the other side, probably steered clear of them. All right. I got 3 plays this weekend, one of them involving our game Sunday night, but we'll start with tonight. Look, there isn't anybody that hasn't said, that's followed this college football playoff after Ohio State destroyed Tennessee and destroyed Oregon, that hasn't said just basically stencil in Ohio State's name on the trophy, the Dr. Pepper trophy for the national championship a week from Monday night. Ohio State's the best team. They're the best team by miles. And they're going to win the national championship easily. The public is lined up on Ohio State. I mean, if you had 2 lines in a sports book, one to bet on Ohio State and one to bet on Texas, there would be nobody in the Texas line. And the Ohio State line, you'd have to get into early in the morning or you wouldn't be able to get the bet in. I'd be the guy in the Texas line. I'm taking Texas plus the 6. I actually kind of like them on the money line too, but the wager, the smell test pick, is major against the public. Ohio State laying 6. I'll take Texas getting the points plus the 6. In terms of thinking about this game, Denton, I really think it's the Michigan model where they stop the run. Ohio State doesn't run it enough, which they didn't do against Michigan, and somehow they get Will Howard off the mark and they rattle him. Texas has arguably the best front 4 in the game. I'm not taking a quarterback that I feel good about in Quinn Ewers. That's part of the problem. And Ohio State's defense has been awesome as well. I think there's a little bit of the Michigan game here for Texas to keep it close. And I think if they end up covering, it's or winning outright, it's 13-10 or it's 17-13, something like that. But I love Ohio State as a team too. I think Jeremiah Smith is the best receiver we've seen in college football in a while. I love the way Ryan Day calls it, and I would expect that they're going to get the ball out quickly into the receiver's hands and make Texas tackle in space. I don't see it from I don't feel confident that Texas can do it if I were just picking the winner of the game without being a better, but this is one of those that just fits the philosophy. The world is on Ohio State. There is some sharp Texas money line money. That has come in over the last 2 days. Hasn't really impacted the point spread because it's been money line money. I like Texas plus 6. We'll kick it off that way. We go to tomorrow, where the biggest public play of the 6 wildcard weekend games, the LA Chargers, laying 3, a perceived very short number against Houston. Look, people are wondering why Ohio State's favored by less than a touchdown with the way they looked against Oregon and Tennessee. And people are wondering why LA's only a 3-point favorite against a team that has not been very good in Houston. I'll take the Texans plus the 3 at home. They can do it defensively. Houston can. And then the last play in the smell test for the weekend is our game, Sunday night. There is more action on Washington than Tampa Bay, but it's not overwhelming action. Where there is overwhelming action is on the over. That line is at 50.5. I'm going to play the under here. I've been talking all week. This has got 30-27, 31-28, 34-31 written all over it. But it's not the way I wager. Every sports book in America will need that game to come in under the total of 50.5. And if you're going to stick with me on this, which you should based on my track record, you should play it sooner rather than later. Why do I say that? I have a feeling there will be a lot of sharp money on the under as well in this one, and that'll bring the number down. Under Tampa Bay, Washington, 50.5. Those are the 3 plays. Texas tonight plus 6. The Texans tomorrow plus the 3. And Washington, Tampa under 50.5 on Sunday night. There were a couple of other things I kind of liked, Denton. I kind of liked the under in the game tonight, too, between Texas and Ohio State. Kind of like the under in the Chargers-Texans games. I like a lot of the unders. You know, I've said this before. The public loves favorites and overs, typically, in standalone games. So if you love a favorite or you love an over in a standalone, nationally televised, no other game going on, you're typically not on the smart side. But there is some smart over action in a couple of these games. But there you go. Texas plus 6 tonight. Houston plus 3 tomorrow. And the Washington-Tampa under 50.5 on Sunday night. Yesterday was significant. The president signed the RFK bill at the White House, surrounded by Josh Harris, Mitchell Rales, and Mark Ein, and the mayor of our city, Mayor Muriel Bowser. Eric Flack's been covering this story in a major way for a long time now. He is at Channel 5 at Eric Flack TV on Twitter, on X. He joins us right now, courtesy of our BetQL guest hotline. So we knew this was coming, obviously, because it was an 11th hour deal. By the way, I haven't talked to you since, you know, kind of that 2 a.m. Solo vote on the RFK site bill. That was a pretty wild, you know, 2 or 3 days. And it really did, right, Eric? It looked dead before it was resurrected, you know, after midnight on whatever date that was, December 20th or whatever it was.
Yeah, I mean, I think that between the team, the team's Capitol Hill, you know, operatives and the mayor's Senate operatives, they had this card in their back pocket, but it was so tenuous that there were zero leaks. There were zero leaks to people like me. There were no other leaks to other journalists out there that I saw. They, because one senator literally could have, if they were motivated to, stuck around until 1:14
sure.
in the morning, they would have had to do that. And so I think they knew that they had to use a bad pun, a Hail Mary option that they felt pretty good about. But I know that nobody, even on the team or on the mayor's side, really celebrated until they heard, Chuck Schumer, the majority leader, pass that vote at 1:14 in the morning with just Tim Kaine in the room there from Virginia.
Eric, it's interesting because Schumer was the one that essentially said, don't look at me, or that's what we thought, go work this out essentially said, go work this out with Maryland. And, you know, with Van Hollen and with Cardin. But the ace up their sleeve, essentially what you're saying is that Schumer, if all else failed and this wasn't attached to as a rider to that, you know, the defense spending bill, that he would do this if all else failed, essentially, was what they had as a go-to at the 11th hour.
I think they knew that as long as they worked out this deal, and there was a lot of 11th hour massaging of individual senators cutting deals with Mike Lee of Utah about D.C. somehow compensating
right.
for the land if they built a stadium there. And, you know, there are a lot of different the fighter jets and all the things. But I think he was fine with it, as long as it didn't become a distraction and everybody on his side was fine with it as well. And ultimately, that's what ended up happening. And ultimately, ironically, as you point out, Schumer was the one who ultimately is the one who delivers the news at 1:14 and will go down in history kind of as the one who kind of officially brought that land back to D.C.
All right. So you and I and people who are paying attention to this story understand that this RFK site bill being passed does not mean that they have a deal to build the stadium there. So why don't you take everybody through what comes next chronologically, and, you know, before we actually end up with a deal. What's the time frame now, and when do the city and the team, and we both know they've already had discussions and may have the framework for a potential deal as well, but when does this thing, you know, become a real negotiation? When does the D.C. City Council end up voting on it? Give me and everybody else kind of a sense of the timeline of the next few months.
So I think there's two things there. One, I think negotiations are happening in full right now, but there is a procedural process called a land transfer, and the land actually technically has to be transferred. It's still under D.C. control till like 2037 based on the first RFK agreement.
Right.
This is going to extend it for 99 years, and there is a legal process, paperwork, I's to be dotted and T's to be crossed, that has to happen, that kind of spell out, you know, some of the handshake agreements that have happened. For example, you know, whether or not D.C. ends up, you know, having to put money back into, you know, parkland if they build a stadium. Those would all go in this land transfer agreement. A lot of these handshake back office deals are going to go into this land transfer agreement that has to be actually signed, sealed, and delivered before the land is officially, you know, in D.C. control. They have 180 days to do that. That work is ongoing right now. D.C. Council, really, you would have to imagine, can't really, you know, vote on anything until that land transfer is complete, because the land transfer very well may have impacts on what the city's financial responsibility is on any deal with the Washington Commanders. But you are under a timeline that everybody is well aware, and we've spoken about before, to get this deal done so the work can move forward. D.C. is, you know, at the kind of walking and chewing gum at the same time, trying to figure out, you know, a timeline for tearing down RFK while what the plans are going to be for the new RFK. Mayor has promised everything from, you know, retail to housing and a stadium. So we've got to see how they're going to get that done. So, I mean, there's this 180-day land transfer timeline, and then that takes us kind of, you know, to the middle of 2025. And then you got to think that it's after that that the council can ultimately vote on a deal. But I think, you know, what I've been told is the land transfer has to be done first before it can officially move forward with the council. But obviously there's going to be, you know, they're not going to wait to start on the deal until the land transfer is done. You know, there's going to be parallel things happening at one time.
Do you see any kind of surprises with just this land transfer agreement? They have 180 days to do it. I mean, we've been surprised with fighter jets, et cetera. Is there any sort of surprise there that could come about?
I don't think so, because, I mean, the land transfer agreement, you know, I guess to the extent that it is unclear, so let's talk about Mike Lee and the Utah and right, putting the land back into federal, putting the money back into federal land if they use it, equivalent value. You know, does that mean any park land or Rock Creek Park? Or is that the federal park land that they're building the stadium on? Meaning, can that money kind of be funneled back into the stadium and the city's financial responsibility? You know, we had talked about in the past how you can get stadium money from the NFL, and it's kind of a loan to build a stadium.
Right.
But you repay
it. It's like $300 million, right?
$300 million, and you repay it in money you were already going to pay the league.
Yep.
This would be a similar thing. Well, I have to repay as D.C. the value of the federal land if I build a stadium there. But if I'm putting that money into improvements to the same site we're building on as my, you know, part of my financial responsibility to the Commanders, then I'm really not paying much at all, and I'm satisfying this deal with Mike Lee. Those details will be interesting. You know, how are they're going to preserve parking? They got to preserve a lot of the environmental land, and those are going to be kind of the details that we're going to see in this land transfer agreement. But I don't expect any huge surprises there.
I mean, I want to just make sure I'm clear on one thing. Mike Lee doesn't have as much leverage today as he did 3 weeks ago.
No. I mean, this is a land transfer agreement that they just have to satisfy. Yes.
Do you see the team and the city entering into some sort of an exclusive negotiating period?
Yeah, I think that's a fair question. You know, the mayor, I don't. The answer is no, because I was messaging, and one of the story I'm working on today, quite honestly, is, hey, Maryland, how did you feel about that picture with all of Commander's ownership standing there next to Mayor Bowser in the Oval Office? Hey, Virginia, because, I mean, you know the reaction on social media. It was like, here we go. This is a done deal. I've already reached out to people on the team and saying, everybody thinks this is a done deal, and they are already telling me, no, this is not a done deal. But you look at the statement itself, and there's kind of a little asterisk at the end of the team's social media post that says, well, we're just really glad they're going to have a seat at the table. Meanwhile, Josh Harris, Mark Ine, and Mitch Rales are smiling from ear to ear.
Yeah.
And you think they're smiling from ear to ear because they're going to see a residential retail facility built that has nothing to do with a football stadium? You know, I know they're all, you know, Harris is a big, like, you know, developer, but that's not the development he's excited about. But there, so the question was exclusive, and I say no, because they are still, they're still continuing with the, what I would like to, you know, in my opinion is a facade, but, you know, that's my opinion, not fact, that, that this is still an open competition. And so we're going to see what Maryland and Virginia, Loudoun County say, if anything, today, along the lines of, I mean, what did you think? Do you think this thing is still going? But if you do have an exclusive negotiating period, then I think you kind of take that idea that this is still an open competition kind of out of
well, if I'm the team, if I'm Harrison Company, I need to know sooner rather than later if I'm going to get 7 votes on the DC Council for the deal that we've sort of kind of come to an agreement on in terms of the framework, because they've been talking about what the deal would look like and what the city ultimately would put up towards this new project, you know, $1 billion, you know what the numbers are, I think it's $1 billion somewhere around there, maybe a little bit more, because, you know, they don't want to get drawn out. So maybe some sort of, you know, 180 day or shorter exclusive negotiating period to get this thing finalized. But to your point, they can't really vote on a deal until the land transfer happens. But yeah, you gotta, from the team standpoint, from ownership standpoint, Eric, you can't have this thing just get drawn out, and then find out, you know, it's going to be 7-6 one way or the other on the vote.
So what Bowser would say, the only thing I'd push back on that part, Kevin, is she will say, well, it didn't look like we had the votes until we had the votes for Nats Park.
Right.
And she will hearken back to, you know, a negotiation that you probably remember, I remember, but not everybody remembers, that was contentious too.
Yeah.
And it wasn't going to happen until it happened. And Bowser's going to say, I got a way to happen. I also can tell you that the team has already, for months, been working the council members. And a lot of the council members, some if not all, have already met with the team. And so the team has a little bit of an idea about what that count is and who's leaning what way. And so, you know, I think that, you know, again, if they don't feel good about DC Council and this deal getting done, do they show up for that photo op? I mean, can they come to the Oval Office ceremony and not take that smiling photo op? To me, pictures speak 1,000 words. I work in television. And, you know, I don't think you can undo, put the toothpaste back in the tube, that visual.
Yeah.
And tell me that that's all about them just being happy that D.C. now has, you know, its own, can control yeah. its own destiny.
Right. All right. Well, I mean, this is going to be a saga that plays out, you know, for another few months. I mean, right now, if I were to say where and when the deal is announced, give me the location and give me when we get, all right, we got a deal and shovels go into the ground on this day to start the process.
A lot of sense. Makes a lot of sense for the beginning of the 2025 football season, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, like, that gives you time.
Didn't we think that was going to be the case with some sort of an announcement in September of 2024?
We did. We did. But we can keep on, like, pushing the goalpost back a little bit. I mean, it gives you time to, I, if I'm not mistaken, the Nats Park deal was also kind of like end of summer, something like that.
Yeah.
And so it kind of gives you the, and don't call me on that part, but it gives you the time to work out the land transfer. It gives you the time to, like, hammer out the deal and not be the issue of 2025, you know, DC Council is hammering out this deal. And then, you know, you announce a thing and then you have some big ceremony to coincide with the beginning of the 2025 football season. It's that sells tickets. It serves so many purposes for the teams. It drives excitement, which is, you know, obviously, regardless of how this season ends, they're going to go into 2025 with so much excitement, so much hope, so much promise. And you have to believe that a clear-cut stadium vision and those plans being out there and coming in 2030 to 2031, coming fall 2030, your new stadium. I mean, we know that they already have the plans. They know what it's going to look like. I bet the mayor knows what it's going to look like, you know. And so, I mean, being able to announce that and have a big ceremony that coincides with the beginning of the 2025 football season makes a lot of sense financially, business-wise, as well as meeting the timeline to get that stadium done.
Good job, as always. Really appreciate the time, and we will obviously be in touch as this story continues to develop. Thanks, Eric, as always.
Anytime, brother. See you. Bye.
Eric Flack from Channel 9, at Eric Flack TV on Twitter X. Gave you the defensive keys last hour. You've got to stop the run. You've got to stop their screen game. Bucky Irving is really good. I think this Tampa offense is an offense that not just, you know, our fans, but maybe NFL fans in general have been sleeping on. This is a team that, you know, averaged 29.5 points per game. They were the number third down offense in the league over the last seven games. And yes, some of the opponents, you know, lacked real ability. They blew out the Chargers. I mean, they had 500 plus yards and 40 points against that Charger defense. This is one of the top offensive teams in the league right now. And they can run it, and they run it in a variety of ways. There's a lot of the counter stuff. When you watched, you, if you go back and you watch just a couple of the condensed versions on NFL.com of the game, you know, the 30-minute versions, you see a lot of that guard tackle counter stuff with Bucky Irving, with Rashad White even, similar to what we do. A lot of action in the backfield as well. You've got to be able to stop the run, and Bucky Irving makes you miss so much. He's really good at making people miss. He's got quick feet. He's got very good feel in close quarters. They got a very good offensive line. Their screen game is exceptional. And then you got a quarterback that is really good at creating time in the pocket, and he is absolutely deadly with the receivers he has and game changers he has when he extends outside the pocket. This is a big-time challenge defensively. My view is you go after him. You don't die a slow death. You don't die a 12-play, 7-minute drive death and hope to hang on in the red zone. You go after them. You try to get them to hurry. And even if it's a chunk play that they go after and a deep shot, we all know deep shots, you know, even when they have an opportunity to hit with protection and man coverage, etc., it's still a hard play to make happen. There are a lot of close misses on those. And so I would go down swinging that way. I would go down swinging with Luvu and Wagner and the most aggressive playmaking players trying to make plays. Then again, you know, you do have to be smart in the screen game, because when you over pursue in the screen game, that's when you get burned. You got to be really good on third down too. They're the number one third down team in the league. This is a challenge defensively, which is why I'll start with on offense. You've got to approach this game. I've said this since the matchup was set up. You've got to approach this game understanding you have to be aggressive. You have to attack. You have to score with the football. You know, if you get 10 possessions in this game, six of them have to end in scores, and maybe seven have to end in scores. You're going to need, more likely than not, 28 plus, maybe 30 plus to win this game. The good news is they're totally capable of it. We've seen it time and time again this year. Although in recent games, there's been an issue. And the issue is early downs. And so I'm going to start with that. You know, big picture, macro, your offense can't come off the field. You got to be aggressive. That means, by the way, being aggressive on fourth downs and trying to hold on to the football. But you've got to have better success on early downs. The last 2 weeks, you know, against Dallas and Atlanta, too many sacks, too many penalties, too many negative TFLs or short, very short runs. You know, we had all those first and 20s. We had second and 30, third and 30. I mean, it was just constant, you know, trying to overcome, you know, ridiculous down and distance situations because of the lack of early down success. They do it, and they've done it all year, coming over, you know, overcoming long down and distances because they've got Superman at quarterback. But you can't live that way against Tampa. You've got to figure out a way to be successful on early downs. I don't think that's by running the football on Sunday night. I think they've got to throw the ball. I think a lot of quick game. They play a lot of zone, Tampa does. Jaden's been very good against zone coverage. When I say quick game, I'm not just talking about screens. I'm not just talking about quick hitches. There's a lot of quick game where that ball is going into the middle of the field to Zach Ertz or to Terry. I mean, we run a lot of slants, you know, and they've been, and Jaden's been successful with Terry, with Noah Brown. I think with De'Ami Brown. I think De'Ami Brown, by the way, along with Eckler, are the two players I expect to be featured a lot on Sunday night. De'Ami Brown has had basically half of his targets and half of his receptions on the season in the last four games. I understand Noah Brown, you know, got hurt, lost for the season, and that stepped up De'Ami Brown's, you know, targets, etc. But I think they like De'Ami Brown. I think Cliff Kingsbury believes that he has the ability to take the top off the defense on deep shots, but with the ball in his hands, even on screens, on slants, on jet sweeps, on reverses that end up and, you know, end up in passes to other receivers in the end zone. Let's try to catch one of those if they run it. I don't know that they will. Who knows? They may try to run that play that they've run twice this year, including in the opener against Tampa, where they try to throw back to Jaden after a backwards lateral to a guy like De'Ami, you know, who can then go left-handed across the field. For whatever reason, the two times that they've run that play, they've not thrown the ball to Jaden when it looked like it would have been a big, big play. But anyway, have to have early down success. And every time I've said that this year, it's like, I understand in the back of my mind, I've watched number five overcome long down and distances all year long. They're not the typical NFL team that gets off schedule and they're dead. They're not dead, but you can't be in these situations this week. Todd Bowles on a second long or a third and long, the blitzes, and he will come after a young quarterback. He did it in the opener, and the blitzes all look different. He's going to play a lot of zone coverage behind. I think a lot of early down, quick game. Doesn't mean sideways, doesn't mean horizontal throws, but I think slants, I think quick over-the-middle throws to Zach Ertz, this is how you have to attack Tampa. Their weakness is beyond the line of scrimmage. It is in their secondary, even though they may be a little bit more healthy for Sunday night's game than they were last week against New Orleans or just down the stretch in the season. And then, look, this is a game in which you can't wait a half to figure out whether or not Terry McLaurin can be an impact in the game. I'm not an advocate of force-feeding 17. I don't think that makes a lot of sense. And I think against Tampa's secondary, you can find Zach Ertz. You can find De'Ami Brown. You can find, you know, Austin Eckler. You can find anybody else that might be playing in the game. Maybe it's Luke McCaffrey, Jamison Crowder, you know, KJ Osborne. Who knows who will be active and up for it. But you can't be off with Terry. When those chances are there for Terry to make a catch and to move the chains, Jaden and Terry have to be back on the same page. They weren't on the same page for any part of the Atlanta game, and they weren't on the same page in the first half of the Dallas game. They got to get back on the same page, but I don't advocate force-feeding Terry. Todd Bowles is too good. He'll take away Terry early from Jaden and make him go to where, you know, the second and third progression takes him. And Jaden's been great at that all year long. But that connection can't be one catch for 5 yards if you expect to win this game. Lastly, you've got to score touchdowns in this game in the red zone. If you're attacking down the field and you have them on your heels, you know, maybe the time to run the ball is when you get in the red zone. And maybe it's with Eckler. We've seen Eckler at various times this year be effective in the run game in pass down or expected pass down situations. But you've got to score. If you're going to score on 6 of 10 possessions, 3 of them minimum have to be touchdowns. 3 of them have to be touchdowns. Lastly, in this game, you know, I mentioned that Tampa, we had a guest on who mentioned it, and we've reiterated it a few times this week. They're the first team in NFL history to have a 70% plus passer and have a run game go for 5 yards or more per carry. They're going to move the football. And it's going to be important that if they do move the football and if it's chunk yardage and they don't score, you're still going to have those red zone opportunities. The red zone will be big in this game. It was last week. It's the reason they won the game last week, but it wasn't all because of their defense. Trey Lance missed a wide open touchdown to Rico Dowdle at the end of the half. He missed Ferguson. He was late on Ferguson. He was late on Tolbert on one of the throws in the end zone. It's not what Baker Mayfield will be. You've got to score touchdowns. You've got to be aggressive in fourth down situations. You have to catch every ball. Zacchaeus has to catch everything. Terry, you know, everybody that's dropped some passes here in recent weeks, you can't drop them. Because I'll tell you what, if it comes down to both teams are effective moving the football, both teams score, and let's just say they both hit on 50% in the red zone, and it comes down to the actual field goal attempts, that's where I'll leave you lastly with. They've got an excellent kicker. Chase McLaughlin's been at 93.8% on field goals this year. He's also got a big leg. I trust him more than I trust our guy, Zane Gonzalez. There's an advantage there, I think, going into this game if it comes down to a couple of kicks, a couple of red zone stops, a couple of kicks, or a couple of long kicks at the end. 93.8% the dude's been on field goals this year. He is also 8 for 10 beyond 50 yards with a 56-yarder to his credit. It's a challenge Sunday night. But, you know, sometimes in these close, like, they can't stop us, we can't stop them, it comes down to quarterback. I feel good about ours.